guys. My name is Morgan. I'm an alcoholic.
Morgan.
I am grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. I'm so glad I was asked to do this because these are the things that I need to do to stay sober. If you had expected me to show up on time and do something when I was actively drinking, this would be nobody out here. You guys would just be looking at your phones going, where is it? And I have some excuse, some lie that I created because I was a completely different person back then. But I'll start with this. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor, who I talked with before I came here. I have a home group, which meets on Sunday nights, right in Maryland. And my sobriety date is February 12th of 2016. So my relationship with God before I came into AA was one of, it was really a sad story because I had no relationship with anything greater than myself. I was my own God. I'm the one who called the shots. I'm the one who thought I had all the answers. And it almost got me dead, to be completely honest with you. After 25 years of drinking, I was dying. I was in the hospital dying. And I'll get into that a little bit more. But, the beginning of my story is probably a lot like everybody else's. I was always restless, irritable, discontent. Didn't really know how to put it into words. Didn't think I belonged. I remember I was in the sixth grade, and I manipulated my parents and my teacher into doing my project for me. And I took that experience and rolled with it for the next, upteen years, where basically I was very manipulating. I would lie just to get what I wanted. And that was kind of even before I started drinking, Like I was a little bit manipulating. I didn't really, I would lie by omission. I wouldn't really tell you what was really going on. I mean, in my mind, it was true. You asked me, well, I thought you said this. I said, yeah, I did say that. It was true at the time. Because I was delusional even before I started drinking. I was selfish, self-centered. And if you had asked me if I thought I was, I would have laughed in your face. I'm a nice guy. I'm just a nice guy who drinks too much. That's really what I thought I was. Until I did the fourth step. We'll get into that. So my first drink, I was 10 years old. It was at a private wedding. And my aunt and I were sitting together. And my aunt's kind of the wild one, in the family. She's passed away. But when I was there, we were sitting at the table and there was champagne and not like hard liquor or anything. It was just like champagne. It was liquid candy to a 10-year-old, right? So she's like, she didn't want to drink alone. So she's like, she gave me a little bit of cup, It's like, drink this, And I was like, well, it tastes great. I've never had anything like this before. So like several hours later and like literally four bottles later, I'm obliterated. I don't remember whose wedding it was. I don't remember what state I was in. But I remember who was sitting at the table. I remember what we talked about. I remember the jokes I told. And I remember how much fun to this day. That was 39 years ago. To this day, I remember how much fun that event was. Because I'm alcoholic. And so it's not like I went out and got a fake ID. The age of 10 and started going to bars. And, it wasn't like that. I didn't really drink again until maybe I was 15 and had a drink because I was trying to fit in at a party. I didn't really like the taste, but I learned later on that if you don't like the taste, but you're alcoholic, it doesn't matter because, you have one. And, the first one's always the good one. It's the drink that you like. And then eventually, it doesn't matter. You're just drinking for effect, for the effect produced by alcohol. And so I started drinking a little bit in high school. And then when I was 17 years old, my father, to give you some background, my father was a recovering alcoholic. He was not drinking. He was dry, but he wasn't working a program. So he was a monster. And even before he quit drinking, he was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Like, he was the nicest drunk guy you've ever met. And he was the meanest sober person, the angriest, most uncomfortable sober. And I didn't understand it as a kid, but now being in recovery and being exactly like him, I totally get it. So He wasn't living with us because of his behavior. My mom was the rock in the family. I was 17. My older sister was 19. My younger sister was 7. And my mom got sick my junior year, the beginning of my junior year. She had always had an issue with colitis. She had problems with her stomach. And back then, in the late 80s, early 90s, they didn't know as much as they know today. So, long story short, she went from like running a marathon and like getting her dream job to dying in open heart surgery in like 2 weeks.
Oh.
So it was devastating. And you know what happens when one parent is no longer can be a parent, the other parent has to come in, which was a catastrophe. But that's because I'm 17 years old and I know everything. My dad doesn't know anything. He's out for bad behavior. Plus, he was my scapegoat. I blamed him for everything. I'm the way I am because of you. Mom isn't here because of you. I mean, for whatever reason. This is like this because of you. And my other scapegoat was God. So God and I were not on speaking terms. God was always talking to me because I should be dead. You know what I mean? I know God was always talking to me. I do. I know now. But I was so angry at God for taking my mom. I was so angry at God for making my dad the way he was. But the truth of the matter is, I grew up in a single family home, in a nice neighborhood, in a nice county. We went on vacation twice a year. I had my own car, that I helped buy. I didn't really go without. Like I had a good deal, and I didn't appreciate it at the time because I'm stupid. And now that I'm not as stupid and I'm older and in recovery, my dad busted his butt. He got up at, I used to wonder, why does my dad get up at 5 in the morning? Like I get up at 6:30 for school. I'm like, why does he just sleep in to like 6:30, 7 like I did? It's so naive. Of course, that's because he's getting up to catch the metro and he's making his way into Crystal City. He has like two trains and two buses he has to take. And he did that for many years. He raised the family. He finally got sober. He finally started working a program. My dad recently passed away, but when he passed, we had made amends to each other and we were really good friends and we knew each other on a level we never did before. So that's a gift of the program. Like, if I had been drinking when my father passed, and he passed of natural causes, I would have, it would, A, it would have been all about me. And B, I would have probably drank myself to death if I hadn't already done that. So when my mother passed away and he moved back in, I went off the rails. Suddenly, I found some friends that drank like I did, that were older. They were like, old enough to buy alcohol. At the time, when you're in the throes of alcoholism, you don't really, you're delusional. You don't see the world for what it is. I mean, at least that's my experience. So I thought, like, everybody drinks like this. I mean, this is what you do when you're in high school, right? You go out till 2 in the morning, lie to your parents, get drunk, stumble home, hide alcohol in your room, drive drunk every day, pretend like everything's okay, go hungover to school. And, but that's not true. Obviously that's not true, but I thought it was. I mean, it was as bad as being in like first period in high school and drinking screwdrivers out of a bottle in front of our teacher, who was very just didn't know what we were doing. And then having to carry my girlfriend out of the room because she was wasted. And this is a different time, obviously. You do that now, it's a different ball game. But it just, I couldn't see what was happening. That's my point. I couldn't see how sick I was. I thought that was normal. I was like, well, if you had the life I had, you drink like I do. If you've been through what I've been through and felt like I felt, you drink like I do. Maybe you would, because the truth of the matter is, for me, alcohol was my medication. It took away the feeling of restlessness, irritability, discontentment, anxiety, fear. That spring we talk about? My spring was getting ready to break when I was 17. And I was finally able to like feel like what I thought you guys felt like. I'm like, well, this is why people drink. It's why my dad drinks. He feels great. So I was incapable of seeing my part in anything. So I basically did whatever I wanted, and I blamed my father, and I blamed God. And my excuse was always the same thing. If you had my life, You would drink like I drink. You would do what I do. And I thought that was a pass. You know what I mean? I really did. I thought that was a pass. It's ridiculously immature. But that's what I did. So a lot of my friends went off to college. I tried to go to school. I was really interested in psychology and computers, kind of a weird combo. But I was like my mother. My mother and I are very similar. She was a psychology major. She had just before right when she passed, she got a job with the American Psychological Association as like a vice president. So she at least reached her goal. And I went in school, but it got in the way of my drinking. And I didn't understand that I was lowering all my expectations and my goals to meet me in my drinking. You know, I didn't see it happen. Obviously, if I was aware of it, I might have done something. I might have, but I was completely delusional is the word that they should put on my when I die. They should put on my casket and my headstone. Just delusional, because that's how I lived the first part of my life. You know, and so I didn't do well in college. Obviously, you know, you can't miss all your classes and drink and expect to get a good grade. It doesn't work that way. So I dropped out and continued to drink. And I started finding odd jobs, had a lot of different jobs. You know, I started bouncing around. And then I met a girl, of course. She didn't drink like I did, but she pretty much tolerated me. And I guess she kind of had maybe a self-esteem issue. I don't know. But it turns out later, she was bipolar, undiagnosed, which explained a lot later on. But I was drinking, but at that point, it wasn't getting in the way of my work, my ability to like hold a job down. I had two jobs. I worked for the NRA in Fairfax full time, and I worked at night at the bowling alley as an assistant manager for a long time. And I thought, I can't be alcoholic because I have two jobs, right? I mean, if I was alcoholic, I'd be like under the bridge with a bottle, you know? And I'm not mad, like I don't have anger management issues like my father. So I can't be, I mean, anything that made me not like you was used to justify that I am not one of you. And I did that for 25 years. And my drinking went from bad to worse to almost death. If I hadn't have gone to detox when I did, I would have died. But I'll talk about that. So I got married. I think after you date for like a certain amount of time, and like this is how my brain functions. If you date somebody for a certain amount of time, whether you like them or not, you now are qualified and expected to get married. So we got married, and at first it was nice, you know. At first it was, and then it wasn't, because my drinking was progressing, and her behavior was very erratic, and we were both working ourselves to death. Like we worked so much that it was really an excuse to just not deal with the real problems in life. It was a scapegoat. So that relationship ended. It ended when she had some kind of a manic episode and took off to another country, and she hasn't been seen since. It is what it
Wow.
is. So it was abandonment. It was devastating to me, but I decided at that point in my life I was going to make a change. I'm like, I'm going to change things. I'm not going to drink as much as I drink. And I met a couple of people who were really successful with their families. They were like the ideal success. They worked for a great company. Their kids adored them. They were responsible. They didn't drink like I did. And it was very attractive because I was kind of looking for a solution, didn't know it. So I started hanging out with them. I actually started to go to church with them too. And things got better, you know, because you are who you associate with, right? I didn't really drink anymore, but I was still like restless, irritable, and discontent. And I started getting in shape. And I'm like, oh man, I'm gonna go back to school. You know, I'm gonna fix all this. And then I decided that having a drink was okay. You all know what happens next. Wasn't okay. Didn't go well. So I drank again. Things got really bad. Then I decided again, out of nowhere, I'm going to change my life again. I'm going to do what I did, but this time I'm not going to drink. So I did it again. I got in shape, got a good job, stopped drinking all the time. And I met probably the woman of my dreams. We met and we did like a 2 year like courtship that we invented, Like we had like goals in a relationship. I mean, it was really great. It was really an awesome experience. Like I'm grateful for it. And finally I proposed and we got married and the wedding was awesome and honeymoon in Costa Rica. And then we started a business. We started making money. We had nice cars, but I was still restless, irritable, discontent. And I started drinking on our honeymoon. I had a couple of drinks. And then shortly thereafter, I was sneaking drinks. And then shortly after that, I was pretty much drinking all the time and just lying through my teeth about everything. So finally, things got really bad as they do. And I was so delusional, I didn't see what was happening. I just thought, well, this is who I am. You know who you marry. No, she doesn't. She never saw me drink. She has no idea who I am. You know what I mean? She had no idea. So that relationship ended. I continued to drink. I started drinking around the clock, to the point where I had it by my bedside, and I would wake up early in the morning with the DTs. I didn't know what they were at the time, but that's what they were. And I would start drinking. And I got to the point where I was unemployable. I was now living with my father because I couldn't afford anywhere else. And I was very naive again. I thought my dad didn't know what was going on. I mean, he's one of us. He was just watching me fall apart, And he did the smartest thing he could do, though. He didn't really do anything except set the example and not put up with my BS. But he set the example. He went to meetings. He took the next right action. He had service at the meetings he went to. And I remember what it came down to for me was the night came where I was drinking. I was out of alcohol. I had like one or two left or something like that. And I knew it was too late to really go anywhere. Plus, you got to understand at this point, I'm so incredibly sick physically that I really don't have the energy to like go to my vehicle and like drive this. So that's how like how sick I was. And I thought that was normal, just delusional. So I told myself that if I wake up in the morning at 5 a.m. or whatever, and I'm climbing the walls, as I called it, because I didn't know what it was, I am going to go ask for help. And I meant it. I meant it. It was the first time I actually meant it. And the reason I meant it was recently I got to the point with my drinking where I could no longer get the euphoria, the mental relief, but I would get physically drunk. And it was a really horrible place for an alcoholic to be. Being physically drunk, bumping into things, no coordination, feeling completely off, but your mind is just as normal as it is when you're sober. It was a living hell. And I don't know about you, but in my case, I tried to chase that high to get that to go away, and I couldn't get there anymore. Next morning came, and I do what all good alcoholics do. Well, it's not that bad. It's not really that. I mean, I have a roof over my head. I own a car. I own a car that's going to be repossessed tomorrow, but I own it today. And everything's okay. I just the ABC store opens at 10. I can probably just like wait till then. Oh yeah, 7-Eleven. I can get beer at like 8 or 7 or whatever. And it dawns on me. There's no gas in my car and I have no money. So what am I going to do? And then something came over me. You can call it a moment of grace. You can call it an intervention from God. You can call it whatever you want. It was I call it a moment of grace from my higher power. This voice said to me, it was not my voice. It said, "Hey man, you asked for help last night. Why don't you get dressed and go up to the hospital and ask somebody for help?" And for whatever reason, I said, okay, Now it's February, so it's cold out, and I'm physically ill from alcoholism. So I get dressed. Here's the good news. My father lived behind the hospital, so I could see the hospital from the porch. So I didn't really have any excuses. But I actually did get in my car, drove it up there. They park it for you. I went in, and I become diabetic by this time. I mean, obviously, when you drink 2 bottles a day for 20 years, you're going to have some problems with diabetes. So I was type 2 diabetic, and my legs were in really bad shape. They were swollen, and my blood sugar was all messed up. And I was taking care of myself, of course. My A1C was 40, it was insane. So I went up there and I told them when I got in the emergency room, I said, "Hey, I'm having problems with my legs," which I was, "and I just need some help." And they're like, "Okay, we're gonna take you back right away," because I had like a mild fever because they were infected. And they take your vitals, they do all that stuff that they do, and they asked me that one question. I had a feeling they were gonna ask me, and I wasn't sure how I was gonna answer. They said, "Is there anything else? Are there any other problems?" And for the first time in my life, I just said, "I can't stop drinking, and I don't know what to do." And I really thought the three-ring circus was going to come out. They're going to look at each other, dumbfounded. I was very nice. They're like, "Well, you know what to do. I don't know what to do. You know what to do. I don't know. Let's go consult with the doctor. Is this in the textbook? Let's go online and Google it." I was really just naive. I thought she just looks dead straight up, and she goes, "We can help you with that." And I'm like, "Okay." And the DTs are setting in now, so I'm shaking. Sort of shake so bad I can't sign paperwork. So obviously they know something's wrong. So they take me in a room. They hook me up to morphine. They roll a TV up. This lady appears. She's sitting at a desk on the TV. I think I'm in Star Trek. I'm like hallucinating because I'm like DTing really bad. She's like, "Are you willing to go into a detox program?" I didn't know what that was. I said, "Sure, I have no idea. Whatever you say is fine." She says, "Were you willing to do this? You willing to do that?" I said, "Yes, let's do that." So they put me in a wheelchair and they wheeled me up to the next floor and then outside, because at this time the cat's detox was at the hospital, but it was not attached to the hospital. It's kind of a weird setup. And they're wheeling me up there. And I'm finally kind of feeling like, okay, this is weird. I've never been through this before. I'm just gonna kind of go with it. And then I realized there was two security guards with us, because when you say yes, you're going. You've committed at that point. For 24 hours, they can hold you. But I was willing to go anyway, so I was like, whatever. But I thought they were police officers, and they knew everything I had done, all the drunk driving. They were taking me to the magistrate on the second floor. This was like an undercover deal. And they were going to process me, and they're going to put a light in my face and say, "Where were you on the night of such and such?" And I wasn't going to be able to remember because I've been drunk for 25 years. And they're going to throw me in jail. I was, the gig is up. And that's not what happened, of course. I got upstairs. They processed me in. They asked me some questions. They started to take care of me. And it was a Friday morning when I got there, and Saturday night, I kind of drew my first sober breath in a very long time. And it started to snow a little bit, like lightly. And I looked out the window, and it hit me. Like everything became clear, that everything was a complete disaster, and I had destroyed everything I touched. And I said, "What happened? What happened?" I didn't get upset. I didn't cry. I didn't get happy. I just sat there and looked out the window, like, "What am I going to do now? What am I going to do?" And the only thing I had going for me at that time was I was looking for a solution and didn't know it. I was actively like, "Well, there's got to be something that will help me," which is ironic because my dad's been in AA for 40 years and I'm looking for a solution. See, I grew up going to Al-Anon and Al-Ateen, so I've only seen that side of the fence. And also, I didn't think I was alcoholic while I was in detox. Good later. And so I started to draw a sober breath. I started to eat some food. I was at very high risk for seizures. I hallucinated when I detoxed. They told me that I was talking to people who weren't in the room and things like that. So I was in bad shape. And I was also 375 pounds. And one thing I didn't share was before I got sober, I got really sick, and my sister took me to the hospital. She's a doctor in Richmond, so she knows what's going on. She said, "You're not taking care of yourself. Your legs are in bad shape. You're going to the hospital." So she took me to the hospital. Turns out I had an infection. They told me that if they can't get the infection under control, you're going to lose both your legs below the knee. Now I'm 42 years old, and you would think that that would be terrifying, right? I was just thinking about, what if I get out of here and drink? I mean, that's how sick I was. And what happened while I was sitting there was the nurse came up to me and she goes, "Mr. Morgan, when's the last time you went to the bathroom?" And I said, "Oh, I think it was like yesterday when I came in. And they've been pumping me full of fluids for like 2.5, 3 days." She's like, "You haven't gone to the bathroom in 2 days?" I said, "No." So they went and checked my levels and my liver shut down. It turned off. So I'm in the hospital, possibly going to lose my legs. And now my internal organs are like, "I'm done. I quit. You know, that's it." And that got my attention. But what really got my attention is when they took me downstairs and they put a dialysis pump on me. You know, 42 years old, going to the hospital because, you know, you think you're not feeling well, you have a little bit of problem with your legs, being told you're going to lose your legs probably. And now you're going to be on dialysis the rest of your life. That scared me. That's the first time I've had major surgeries as a child. I've been very ill as a child with an immune deficiency disorder. But I've never been as scared as when they put that pump on me and they said, "Your life is never going to be the same." So they do what they do, though. They fixed me. They got my enzyme levels down. They got the infection under control. They put me in a hyperbaric chamber, pure oxygen therapy. You know, I didn't know about all this, but they did. So they fixed me. So after that experience, what happens to an alcoholic like me when I feel better and don't have a solution? I went right back out. Like the next day when I got discharged, lied to my sister and I went out and drank. And then that's when my sister finally said, "You know, this is out of control. I'm taking you to the hospital and you're staying. And then we're going to talk about what we're going to do." So I went to the hospital again. I was basically told, "If you come back here again, you're probably not going to leave." And even then, I went back out. So now I'm homeless in Fairfax County. And then I move in with my father. And then that's when I had that moment where I woke up, said, "I'm going to ask for help." And I woke up and I went to the hospital. So I was in detox. And they brought in a meeting Monday night, or yeah, Monday night. And I met my sponsor that night. Now, here's the thing about like detoxing with my experience. Everybody who was there on vacation. They weren't there to get stay sober. They're there to get the heat off. They're there to get their parents, you know, to trick their parents. It was obvious. I mean, their parents, one of the parents brought like his kid, like sugar cereal, all his Marvel DVDs, cookies. I mean, it was ridiculous the enabling that was going on. But it was kind of cool because I like the movies, you know, so there's that. But anyway, so then I went to the meeting. And you know, went to the AA meeting that they brought in, and I'll be honest with you, I was pretty desperate because I knew what was going to happen when they let me out of there. I was going to drink because I felt good. I felt the best I had felt in a very long time, and I thought there was nothing wrong with me now because my liver's working, my legs aren't bad yet, so I can drink, and that's what alcoholism tells me. So they brought a meeting in. And they started talking about things that I couldn't put into words, things that I related to. And they had this sense of peace about them and the sense that they had something that I wanted. Like I immediately wanted it. I'm like, "What do you have? You have something. I don't know what it is, but I want it." You know, and here's the thing. I was looking for a solution and I had surrendered. So I knew that's the things I had going for me. I finally admitted that I can't do this myself and I need help. And I was willing to take the help. And I asked for help. And I told my now sponsor, "Hey, here's my number. I'm going to call you when I get out." He's probably heard that 1,000 times like I have. But I called him, got on Wednesday morning. I was feeling really good. And guess what? I was thinking about doing. So I called him instead of drinking. I called him and said, "Hey, what's going on, man? You met me, blah, blah, blah." He goes, "Yeah, I remember you." He later told me, he's like, "You were the last person to call me. You were the last person." He's like, "I wrote you off." And I'm like, "Thanks." But anyway, so I called him. He left work early. I found out later. He left work early and he came and picked me up and took me for coffee. And like, I was so starved for like social interactions. I'm very extroverted. But the mere fact that somebody was willing to like talk to me, come over, pick me up, and take me out was like awesome. Plus, I started to feel safe because I knew I was with somebody who wasn't going to let me drink. Just like when I was in detox, I felt safe because I couldn't drink in there. I mean, well, you probably could if you wanted to, like most of them did, but I didn't want to. So he took me to a Wednesday night meeting, my first AA meeting. It was called Up the Tubes. There was 125 people there of all different backgrounds, all different ages, all different professions, all different vehicles, motorcycles in the parking lot. And it felt really good to be in an environment where people were happy and they were willing to talk to me. Because nobody was talking to me at the end. Nobody was, I was basically my friends. I had burned all those bridges. So I was actually enjoying myself. And then I realized when the meeting started, I have no idea what they said. I did know this though. There's three people at the front. They must be the leaders of AA. And if I want to stay here, I got to get in good with them. So I need to A, write their names down. So when I meet them, I had all these plans going on. Needless to say, it was just service work. They were just up there doing their work. And I don't remember what they talked about, but I remember some people shared and I could relate. And I remember at the end, people came up to me and said, "Hey, what are you doing tomorrow?" And I said, "I don't know, but what are you doing tomorrow?" They're like, "Well, we're going to pick you up." And I thought that was cool because nobody wanted to hang out with me. So I was like, yeah, okay, we'll do that. And I didn't have any money. So they're like, "Well, we can go out to the diner." And I was like, embarrassed, I didn't have any money. And they could tell. So like, "Hey, we're just going to take you out to dinner. We're going to have a good time. It's going to be fun." And so we do a meeting, went out to the diner, rinse and repeat. My sponsor said, "Hey, are you serious about doing this?" Like, because he has 27 years of sobriety. He's been around. He's like, I need to know that you're serious." And I said, "Yes." Whether I meant that or not at the time, it just was the right answer. They said, "Well, this is what we're going to do. You're going to go to a meeting every day. You're going to call me every day. You're going to start step work immediately." And I said, "Okay." I don't know why I said okay. I just said okay. Started to do my step work with him. Did my four step. Tried to evade it like we do, alcoholic. "Oh man, I'm not available that night. Oh, I got this going. I have service commitment that night." Bunch of BS. Finally, he set a date. "We're doing it at this time on this day at my house." Click. Okay. All right. You got me. So I spent a couple hours. I did it. It wasn't fun. You know what I mean? Let's just be honest. But I felt good that I accomplished something that I said I was going to do. It's like the first time in a long time where I actually finished something I started. It said I would finish. So I was like, "Well, that's kind of cool. I finished. I'm ready to go. We can do this thing." And we went to his townhouse. At the time, he had a townhouse, and he took me upstairs to his office. And he had me sit in the chair in the office. And he sat in the chair in the doorway, in the doorway. And I was like, "What is going on?" I later was told that's so you don't run out. That's so you didn't just get up and run out. So I read him my four step, and I thought like he was going to be like, "Dude, you're too sick. I can't help you. You got to leave. Give me your chips back. We'll have somebody cover your service." Just so stupid. And he looks at me and he goes, "Okay, well, here's my experience." And then he shares a story far worse than any of mine. And then I thought to myself, as an alcoholic does, "Well, I don't know if he could sponsor me now." Complete flip. But then I got over it. I said, "No, he's a great guy. He's helping me." I didn't have any white light moment. I didn't like float out of there, and everything was peachy. I didn't even, you're supposed to go home and like sit quietly for an hour. I sat quietly for 3.5 minutes because that's like the best I can do. And then I went to work, and then I went to a meeting, and he said, "Are you still serious?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You will get a service commitment at every meeting you go to right now." And I didn't know if that was like a definite. I didn't care because I was feeling better. It's like, you just tell me what to do. So I got service commitment. I started making friends because I was getting to the meeting early. And I'm here to tell you, service saved my life. It did. And he was like, you will get service if you want my help. So I said, okay. So I got coffee and setting up the chairs. And I didn't think I was qualified for like secretary, you know. So I was like, no, I can't do that. I haven't earned my place yet, you know. And so I, you know, I had service. I got there early, and then we would go get something to eat, and we come to the meeting, and then I made friends. And, you know, and the truth of the matter is, this is a deadly disease. Some of those people, when I got sober, either A, are not here, or D, I've been to their funeral. You know, they had more sobriety than I have a pigeon brother who helped me get sober, who I looked up to, who I followed around, and he went back out 2 years ago and he's dying. You know, but my job is to help the next sick and suffering alcoholic. My job is to set the example and hope to God that he comes back, you know, when he's had enough, you know, that time when you just you've had enough. But so, you know, it's just rinse and repeat for me. I just do the same things over. You know, I drive from Falls Church to Madison and speak at a meeting or participate in some way. But this is where I'm happiest. Like, I'll wake up today. I woke up, I slept in, I sleep in on Sundays, and I did the things I had to do, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm getting over a sinus infection, so you know I'm feeling sorry for myself because I'm a good alcoholic. And I'm like, oh man, you know, I'm definitely not going to cancel this. That's just not right. But man, I still want to go. I got to get the oil change in my car because of the shoes. So I'm like, you know, having a pity party. And then I do remember in the back of my mind that the only time I'm really ever content is when I'm doing something in AA. I'll chase. I mean, I'll chase cars, I'll chase money, I'll chase opportunity. Think still to this day, just being honest, thinking it's going to fix me or make me feel better. And it might for 5 minutes, you know, it might, but it doesn't. It's not the solution for me. And I have to, the only way I'm reminded that that's not the solution for me is when I come to the solution, which is here. And that's when I'm reminded. So I come to meetings, I stay active. I've trained my feet, which is good. So it doesn't matter how I'm feeling or what I want or what I don't want. I just go to the meeting. Where's Morgan on Sunday nights? He's at his meeting in his home group. Where's he Wednesday nights? He's out at the tombs. He has service there. Where's he on Monday night? He's at the gift. He has service there. Tuesday night, Virginia Big Book. He has service. He's there. And, you know, having 7 years of sobriety and being in a good place and working a strong program doesn't mean I don't have to go to 7 meetings a week. I have to find what worked for me. And what works for me is 6 to 7 meetings a week. That's where I'm okay. I'm here to tell you, I didn't go to a meeting last night because I went on a date. I felt it today. I was like, what is wrong with me? I feel off, you know? I know I'm not feeling that well, but why am I so annoyed with everything? You know? Why do people at Jiffy Lube piss me off? And all they did was smile and help me. You know, and then I get home and I'm like, yeah, I've been going to a meeting every Saturday night for the last 7 years. Last night was maybe one of the one or two times I haven't, and I was feeling it. And I'm like, okay, well, that just confirms what I already knew. I mean, I'm not like some. There's people who can go to 3 or 4 meetings. And that's fine. There's people who can go to 2 meetings and have sponsees, and that's great. I can't do that. I know it works for me. So I basically do whatever the program tells me to do to keep me sober. Like, I do the same thing I did in the first day. It's the same thing tonight. The only difference is I'm further down the road. But here's the other problem. Alcoholism is so progressive. Because when I quit drinking for that time frame that I told you about, when I went back to drinking, not only did I pick up where I left off, I was several years down the road. Because within 6 months, I was drinking myself to death. Now, here's the reality. If I pick up a drink tonight, I'll be dead in a week. I'll just go ham. It'll be out of control. And I know that. And a lot of people are like, you really think that? I'm like, I've been there. I stopped drinking for a while and convinced myself I was an alcoholic. And then I picked up a drink. And guess what happened? Immediately, that switch was flipped. And I was back in the same place. And I'll tell you this much, That switch was flipped when I went out to dinner with my ex-wife. We went out to dinner to celebrate a business deal. And we went to a really nice restaurant right by where we live. And I ordered a beer because she ordered a glass of wine. She did not finish my glass of wine. It bugged the hell out of me. That should have been a sign. I don't know why I ordered some beer that I couldn't pronounce. And the waitress, the one thing you don't do to alcohol, she complimented me on my selection and how I paired it with my steak. I'm like, yeah, it's red. Ego. Ego never goes away. So, I drank the beer. I didn't like order five or what. I just had the beer with my dinner. But I do remember feeling off the rest of the night, like restless. I didn't realize it at the time, but when I look back, I was like, oh my God, because you know what I did the next day? I went down to the Harris Teeter that we lived above in our unit, and I said, I don't have any business till tonight. I could probably have a drink. It's not a big deal, right? I'm not an alcoholic. Well, you don't have a beer at dinner the night before after not having a drink for several years, and then the next morning go downstairs and buy a case of Bud Light and drink the whole thing, which is exactly what I did. That was normal to me. I was really embarrassed, so obviously I hid from my wife. I said I had to take care of something. I was gone overnight. Then from there it went downhill. Got really, really bad. Went from beer to wine to liquor. I even was buying moonshine for Front Royal. It was really bad. And I actually bought a bad batch one time and I lost my vision. I had to go to the hospital. That was very scary. So here's the thing. I'm alcoholic and I'm never going to change. I'm always going to be more than the alcoholic. It's going to have the same tendencies, the same delusions, the same thought processes, the same bad ideas that I think are great ideas. And I have to do the things I've learned here, which is run it by my sponsor, run it by you guys, do service, don't drink, help the new guy, tolerate the guy who you pick up and insult your car because he's feeling bad about himself. Or insult somebody or offend you in some way because he's as sick as you are. But I have to do those things. And a lot of times people say, well, don't you think that's like not fair? Like my girlfriend that I'm dating is not one of us. But it's really cool dating somebody who's not one of us, because like a normie as I call him, because she'll challenge me. I'll say something and she'll be like, why did you say that? And I'll be like, yeah, why did I say that? I don't even know why. It's stupid. I say it again. I'm like, that was dumb. So she would say, well, doesn't that seem unfair? Don't you feel kind of like it's unfair? I said, what's unfair is that my life is awesome and there's somebody out there right now who doesn't even know that this exists. That's unfair. My life is good. I am what I am. You are what you are. You have your own struggles. I have my own struggles, but I have a solution. So with that, I really think I've talked myself to death. I appreciate being invited. It's been my pleasure speaking. Thanks. Yeah.